Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Late Nights with the Midnight Bomber with Neutron Bomb and Captain B2. Pour it out thick like honey, bittersweet like molasses, seeking your proliferous journey to profit to the empathetic masses, calling on cathartic release, expel your demons, if but for a moment increase, then cease them, quell their influence, let them not commit treason. Whilst it is not a prerequisite, we do encourage you to join the Late Night Poets group on allpoetry.com. The call-in number is 657-383-0024. How's everyone going tonight?
And if you don't join it, you're missing a hell of a lot of fun.
This is very true, Captain.
The party starts here.
Yeah. Well,
how you doing this evening, my friend?
I started the party early. I was playing music and managed to get neighbor complaints, two of them. So... moral of the story is put your headphones on.
Oh, hell with them if they can't take a joke. Some people complain. If you gave them $1 million, they complained that it was all green and wrinkled.
Oh, gosh. How are you today, Captain?
I am splendid. Thank you for asking. I'm, let's see. Every day is a holiday. Every meal's a feast. Every formation's a parade. Every paycheck's a fortune. I love it here.
Woo!
That's what we used to say when I was in the Corps. I love the Corps.
And how are you tonight, Mika?
I'm doing okay. How are you guys?
Yeah, okay. Good.
Come on, girlfriend, you're with us now. It's got to be better than okay.
That is always good.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm one of those really annoyingly perky people. And when I walk into a restaurant and the seating hostess says party of one, I said absolutely. Everywhere I go, I'm a party.
I don't doubt that in the slightest.
Well, I look at it this way. Who wants to be in the same room with someone that sucks all the oxygen out of it?
Indeed. And Mika, do we have anyone on the line?
Yeah.
I think Mark was thinking of calling in.
We don't so far.
That's all right. I'm happy with the three Amigas. And we will see if we get some more people as the show progresses. And so tonight's show, I totally crapped out on introducing that, is a series of prompts by Jean-Paul Sartre, mostly based on Sartrean existentialism. We had quite a few rights.
Oh, my gosh.
We've got 20 on the board. Yeah, 20 on the board. And, so I'll get started with the first one. It's by Cedarhaven, and it's called Perestroika. Goose Grey, she bends her knees, pop, pop, scattershot arthritis, pain flares like flashbulb, and bows her head before the gold gilt grave of God. He watches the man in black, hears the chime of the golden chains that drag her to this place and hold her down. She whispers words to a piece of wood, to a piece of marble, to the wax that pools in wrought gold worth twice the man in black salary. She cries out for God, but the wood and marble and gold do not answer. The weak morning sun streams through the stained glass. It touches her face and the man in black as well. He accepts her teeth, whispers green benediction, and counts the bills that she gave them. No gold chain weighs him down. Her money builds her stairway, and he crafts it in meals for the hungry, medicine for the sick. He sweeps out this tomb and waits for the next supplicant, chained and desperate. Freedom is a bird that flies high enough to see the wide world. The man in black is free enough. He bows to the altar. God does not return his calls, but he makes them anyways. End poem.
Wow. What an opener.
Yeah, I had to pick it. I changed my mind at the last second. I thought this was just epic.
Mika, did you opening with fireworks?
Yeah, yeah, and it only gets better than this. Like it was a really strong week with the ride.
Yeah, extremely strong ride.
And did you want to go first, Captain?
With the comments? Sure. Since I've already intruded. Yeah. This is amazing. I mean, I know Sartre is the philosophical points of it, but this is amazing. I mean, it's just, it doesn't really take any kind of positive or negative sway to it, but it's almost like someone who's not familiar with what's going on is looking through the window and watching this. I mean, the man in black hears the chime of the golden chains, drag her to this place and hold her down. She whispers words to a piece of wood, a piece of marble, to the wax that pools in wrought gold worth twice the man in black salary. I mean, that is, if this isn't a really antiseptic characterization of organized religion. It's very cynical, but not in a negative way. It's just, it's almost an antiseptic observation of what's going on. But it's so beautifully written that it's like cold water in your face.
Yeah, I totally agree with you there. Cold water on the face. And Mika, what did you think?
I would love to comment, but first I want to let you know that we do have someone joining us, and this is area code 646. You're on the air. And who are we speaking to?
Hi. Hi, guys. This is Mark, Mark Lupin.
Oh, great.
Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Welcome, Mark.
How are you all? I was listening to the poem reading.
Glad to hear you.
Yeah. Glad to be here.
Outstanding.
I'll get you up after Mika, Mark. But Mika, what did you think of the poem to start off with?
Oh, I thought it was brilliant. I think my favorite part is, you know, first of all, awesome prompt choice. I think we were talking about Sartre a couple shows back, and he's one of my favorite philosophers and writers. But I love the way that she approached this prompt. And I think what she really, really captured is the way that Sartre talked about perception and the way that you perceive things, the way that you believe in things, coloring how they are in reality. I think the most intense part for me was her money builds her stairway. Her money builds her stairway. That to me was really striking because when you think of a stairway, it could go up or down. And in saying her money builds her stairway and talking in context with the rest of the poem, talking about her golden chains, it's almost like her money is a stairway down. And her hope whenever she's supplicating is not for others, is not for good itself, but rather for a very narrow healing of her own arthritis, of her own ills. And she's unable to focus on anything other than the physical aspects of what she's praying to, the wood, the marble, the gold. And all of this prayer and the money, the expectation that she has within herself is laying a stairway, and it seems to be a stairway downwards. It's not creating any healing for her. It's not adding any good to the world because it's focused only inward and only on the golden trappings. And then you have that character contrasted with the man in black who, whether he believes or not, is using the benefits of the money that's tithed to actually do good in the world. And then it seems like he has comfort, and he's almost indifferent to whether God returns his calls or not, because he himself is answering his own calls, which are of a more broad nature of good for more than just the self, and completely unfocused on the material, only looking at the material goods that he gets in tithes as a means to an end. I thought it was really good.
Great comment.
It definitely was. It just reminds me of that saying that you have heaven and hell within you. But I'll get Mark to comment first. Mark, what did you think of the poem?
Yeah, well, they were great comments. It's a beautiful poem, and as noted already, the Latin writing here in language is incredible. You know, the wax that pulls in wrought gold, and the imagery of the whole machinery of religion, because that's what's almost presented here, a processing plant for supplicants. But it's done so beautifully and so well. This is the priest here is, you know, not, as already noted, it's not malevolent. It's almost like a loving presentation of religion, but it presents it as this kind of machinery that's processing these suffering people coming in that are trying to make a real connection with something. And there's no cynicism to it. It's just kind of matter of fact, showing the beauty of the whole thing, the beauty of the ceremony, the beauty of the institution, that it does do good for hungry, meals for the hungry, medicine. But in the end, the poet's view is that the phone calls are not returned. This is sitting there filling a need, but at the same time, there's a real beauty to it, but a kind of real aspiration that God does not return his calls. So it's, you know, deeply sad too. It's a lovely poem.
Great
poem. It was, wasn't it?
Yes.
The opening stanza had great internal rhyme, and it really set up the rest of the poem. I was drawn to the same section you were as well, Captain, with the "he cries out for God, but the wood and marble and gold do not answer."
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It speaks to the essence of the prompt that, and this is it here, that God does not exist, I cannot deny, that my whole being cries out for God, I cannot forget. And this hit home for me, the reality is that for some belief in God is futile, whilst for others it provides immense comfort. And I think she's captured that duality with poise and grace.
Yes.
So very well done.
Yeah. And the comments, Mark and Mika's comments, different points of view, but both beautifully. I love Mika's comments about the religion and Mark's about it being a factory, almost industrial in its references. Both great comments.
Thank you, Captain. And I've just dropped your poem on the board if you would like to read it when you're ready.
Are you on mute, Mike?
Sure.
Mark?
Yeah. No, I'm okay now. Yeah. I wrote this a long time ago. but I've always been attracted to Sartre, but I've always had concerns about where it leads you to. So anyway, it's his famous quote, "Hell is other people." That's from one of his plays at Close of Exit, where three people are trapped in a room and getting on each other's nerves. So, but in any case, that's the very famous quote. And this is a poem about it. Freedom Intake. Halloween party in a Sartrean fair. Too many kids around. I'm tired of tricks. Want to go rowing in an easy chair with therapist Charon on the river Styx. Standing in darkness, casually brushing back hair while an unseen power all my charms extols. High in the midnight, I'd be made aware of freedom, golden hospital for lost souls. I like this golden mirror's vacuous stare, balancing stably on the shimmering walls. I like this golden desk and golden chair. I like the thoughtful people in these halls, the cranium's vacant visage, whitewashed as a reassuring wall. I smile and pass.
Very well done. I'm going to take the first comment on this one because I got really excited about this poem. the opening stanza, I really enjoyed. Firstly, you managed to make it rhyme with Trix and Charon on the River Styx, and I thought that was really impressive. So that has to be said there. But I did a bit of research when I was reading your poem, and freedom, according to Sartre, permeates every aspect of the human condition. And he asserts that the mere existence is freedom, and every individual has a choice, and it is this choice that characterizes each individual's being. And all these kids are so focused on individualism, and there is an inherent disconnect, which you mentioned earlier, Mark, and they are together at this Sartrean fair, but isolated in what you mentioned in the author note is sterile isolation. And you would generally expect the kids to be interacting given the reference to Halloween. And also, if you're tired of kids, why go to a Halloween party? And I think that human tradition does not fare well at a Sartrean fair. Then you go on to want to go rowing in an easy chair with therapist Charon on the River Styx. For those of you who are unaware, to
Charon is a psychopomp, which is a creature or deity in many religions who's responsible for escorting newly deceased souls from Earth to the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, he is the ferryman of Hades, who carries souls of the newly deceased across the River Styx, dividing the world between the living and the dead. I just really enjoyed this thought-provoking poem. Really, I could spend half an hour on this, but it wouldn't be fair to the rest of the poet. But the idea of Sartrean freedom being a golden hospital for lost souls was very fucking clever. And hell is other people indeed. Just a very clever parody, and I was very impressed with the write. And, Mika, what did you think?
Thank you.
I liked it. I was kind of, I really liked your comment, Neutron. I think the part that I was most drawn to is probably on the stanza with the mirror. Because it made me really think of what is the golden mirror's vacuous stare. It's almost like when you have the mirror stanza right above the stanza with the cranium's vacant visaged people. It's like the only gaze that is acceptable, that's pleasant, is your own. That's tinged in the light of self adoration. Almost, I felt like it was a kind of a rejection of an objective observer to the self. And that's why it's so reassuring to have people who are cranium vacant, whitewashed as a reassuring wall as you smile and pass them, and why your own mirror is golden. Also, I wanted to let you guys know we do have one other caller. I'm going to bring them on real quick.
Yay!
Hello. Hello, folks. Hello, Billy.
Hi. Hi.
So before I start, I hope I'm right in understanding. So did you say that at one point you were a belly dancer, Billy? Was that you or is that somebody else?
It's Bobby and
Billy
here.
Bobby. Or Bob.
Oh,
Bobby,
yeah.
I meant to say. Sorry, yes, not Billy.
Oh, that's all right. I know the difference. That's all that matters.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I had been at one point. That was,
oh, okay.
That was several,
well,
seasons,
you might,
several seasons you, ago, though.
Oh, okay. Well, you might recognize this.
Oh, yeah. Love
and then
it.
That's, we actually are still commenting on a certain poem, though.
Yeah.
Did
yeah.
you happen to hear the poem, Robbie?
Yeah, I was just doing that for Billy before I did the poem. Yeah, I I was listening to your freedom poem there, and it reminded me. I'm just pulling it up because it's one of those poems that for me, when I listened to it, it was almost more of a poem to look at as opposed to be hearing, because the way the images worked. Somehow they to me they translated more to more easily, like when I'm looking at the words. But there's a couple of interesting things that with this poem, it's like it went in some directions for me that I think maybe wouldn't have been intended, but it's interesting that they went there. This freedom intake, like he's saying that, well, you know, I'd really rather be by myself more than with other people, right? Like I like this golden mirror's vacuous stare, and then it says too many kids around in that. And so I don't know why or how, but somehow this poem to me sounded like the opposite of a poem that would be saying, well, I want to be around other people. And it's just kind of an interesting thing that it worked for me that way, where you would have the one poem that it would almost be like the reverse of this, where you would be like, you know what, I changed my mind. I actually want to be around other people. And I don't know how or why the poem did that for me, but it did that for me. And a couple of the images here with the golden mirror's vacuous stare And then, oh, Golden Hospital. Those golden references reminded me of, in metaphysics, like the golden path, sort of like the middle path. And then there in Taoism, I think, there's the golden pill, which is like kind of the idealism, you know, like the kind of the ideal way. And again, that's probably something that wouldn't have been intended, I don't think, by the poet, but those golden images had reminded me of those metaphysical references of gold in various traditions to like kind of an ideal way. So very kind of more philosophical, tangential, existential. It's what I got from the poem.
Mike, did you want to make a comment about the poem? It's up to you. Or I can jump on to...
Myself? Me? Well, great comments, guys, is one comment I wanted to make. Everybody got so deeply into it. Obviously, you're all looking at the same type of topic in your lives and stuff like that in the past. This one, I've been always... I loved Sartre. I'll just say that I loved it, Sartre, his novel Nausea, and his plays and his philosophy. But I was also kind of pushed back by it. There just seemed to be a non-connection, people and history in a lot of ways in his philosophy. And in the end, I decided it's, what is freedom? You have to figure that out for yourself and mix it the way you want. But if all you care about is your own individualism and freedom, and you take that to an extreme, then it puts you, I feel, in a sterile place. It has to be balanced with connection and dependency and in your community and stuff like that. So to me, I think this is, I wrote this so long ago. I was just a kid in college, and that's where it comes out for me, the whole puzzle of freedom and how it can take you to an isolated place. So that's what I'd say about the poem.
And I guess it's like it becomes something different when you become older, or it's like different things for different people. It's not very much of a universal thing, is it?
Yeah.
And Captain, would you like to make a comment and then sure. Go into reading the poem?
Yes, ma'am. I'll be pithy. How's that? I really enjoyed this for brevity. I get the impression the protagonist isn't really keen on where he is. However, he's impressed with himself. Stanton is casually brushing back hair while an unseen all my souls high in the midnight, I'd be made aware of freedom, golden hospital for lost souls. And I think I get the impression with the golden mirror, the golden walls, the golden desk. By the way, vacuous is one of my favorite words. Thank you. I like the thoughtful people in these halls. It seems that the only reason the protagonist is around the people is hoping that they will notice his charms, how wonderful he is, and reinforce that image he has of himself. Otherwise, there's no reason for people. He can look in the mirror, and he's already convinced of how wonderful he is, but he needs the other people with the craniums, the vacant visage, whitewashed as a reassuring wall. I smile and pass, waiting for them to reinforce his opinion of himself.
Oh, that's so funny. You're right. The parody of narcissism is there.
Yeah. And while freedom is defined personally, so is hell. Your definition of hell is also very personal. I would listen to opera, and that might be someone's personal definition of hell, listening to opera, whereas my listening to country and Western music or listening to young women talk through their nose, that would be my personal definition of hell. So that is also very individual. And it's also reinforced by another philosophy. Omar Khayyam said, I myself am heaven and hell. So you create your own hell.
Great. And Captain, would you be able to, I've dropped the poem in the forum by Richard Levi.
Okay, let me I'm looking for it here. Well, there it is. Okay, the sixth commandment. There we go. I live for these requests. I love to read. Where are you? There it is. Okay. The sixth commandment for Richard Levy. Isn't it bad enough that we are mortal, age, are subject to disease and injury and die? I have some sympathy for committing suicide, although anti-vaxxers seem benighted to me. But to kick one another down the path of death seems cruel. Of the four horsemen, only war do we wage on ourselves. Really, whether authorized by a tribe, religion, or government, if you die in a good cause, aren't you still dead? Doesn't the blooming of a flower lovely? Doesn't shortening the time it's blooming make it more so or less? I'm also struck by all of these mass shootings. What are these people thinking, if they are thinking at all, that they are heroes? That if they are, to who? That they are somehow justified in taking all of those lives, some grievance perhaps, that their victims deserve it. And yet there are those who wish to make guns more available so they can do it more conveniently. What are those people if not complicit in these murders? All in the name of freedom? Really, that should be freedom. This may be as good a place as any to end this journey. End poem.
Thank you, Captain. That was a great read. And to let you know, Richard wrote to the prompt, I say murder is abstract. You pull the trigger, and after that, you do not understand anything that happens. And
yeah.
Mark, would you like to make the first comment?
That's a lovely quote from Star Trek. I've never come across that, but you know, it's just the whole
very faint.
Oh, sorry. Can you hear me better now?
Much better. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a lovely quote from Sartre. I've never come across it, but it makes you think. You know, what is the idea of killing? You don't really understand it, I guess, until you've gone through it and done it, which hopefully never happens. And the thoughtful comment and a very thoughtful poem reacting to it. It's beautifully written, and it takes you through a thought process of, you know, who are we as mortal people subject to injury? What's going to happen? Do we? And the interesting poem of the four horsemen, the four deadly forces that can kill us. Only one, really, wars. We do to ourselves. The rest we just have to kind of endure. It's just a very thoughtful poem, and I really love the way he takes it. It kind of increases in power as he goes through it. He talks about mortality than the four horsemen, than the mass shootings. He leads on to that, what we actually do to ourselves as war and murder and the people who actually open fire on other people. It's just very thoughtful and very strongly stated. And above all, I love the last stanza. I mean, why? It's beautifully stated. It made me actually think while it was being read. Why the people actually, you know, if you sell automatic rifles, they're not for hunting or anything, or even self-defense, something that can shoot out hundreds of rounds in a minute. And yet they're freely sold, and people make them. They're making them for murders, for future murders, as the poem that we actually have a society that sells products to kill other people en masse, not for self-defense or hunting. And the poem presents it so well and strongly. Why is this happening? Why is this even allowed? It's just a beautifully written, very moral poem that really makes you think. Great poem.
Thanks, Mark. I agree with you there. I really like the philosophical musings posed by the questions in this piece. And I think the poet really answered the prompt well. It was balanced and thought-provoking. I liked the last stanza with the play on words with freedom and freedom. From guns to manufacturers, massacres, anti-vaxxers, the misinformation, the self-interested lobbyists. I think Richard really hit home with this poem. Very well done. And Robbie, what did you think?
Well, I find this very much a poem grounded in reality and what's happening, in as much especially as I hear people say this kind of sentiment, you know, and when I talk to them about the way the world's going in that, it's unfortunate. It's like almost existentially laughable, you know, that we're doing ourselves in, you know. And I remember some this actually brings to mind, it just popped in my head. Someone said, like, you know, we basically, I can't exactly how they said it, but they basically said, well, you know, we could be better. Why aren't we? It just makes you think of the absurdity of, you literally could make the effort to do better, and yet so many people just don't. And personally, I think it's rooted in human ego. Ego to me is they say money is the root of all evil. But I think that very much too, ego is one of the kind of the primary roots of everything that goes on. And this listed it out all very well of a lot of the prime things that we do that, like, you know, we were talking about mass shootings and that really do us in. And so it was a very existential but very real poem at the same time.
Excellent comment, Robbie. And Captain, you read the poem. What was your take on it?
I think this is a very powerful social commentary. It asks out loud. It materializes the questions we ask ourselves every time one of these news flashes comes on that there's been yet another shooting, and more lives have been ruined, and you know, and it does delve into questions that others have asked them. What are those people, if not more complicit in the murders, the people who make the firearms? And truthfully, I've fired a M16 on automatic, and we used to call it squirt. You have automatic and semi-automatic, and they say put it on squirt, and the rounds come out so fast, you can't see where they're going. What's the point of that unless it's warfare? Or just just mass extermination, because that's what it is. It's a weapon of killing, and it's not for hunting. I mean, you know, a deer doesn't shoot back. So, you know, you need one round to take that one down, and that's it. But these it asks a lot of questions. Like I said, that what are these people thinking? And I think there are bodies of people studying, trying to figure out what is motivating this. And the thing that I find most embarrassing is, proud as I am of my country, of our country, that we experience this more than any other nation on earth. I mean, we don't seem to realize, a lot of people don't seem to realize it, to secure a safety, sometimes you have to give up personal liberties. And I think we've all experienced that going through the airports now. used to be you could breeze in and breeze out, and you could meet people at their gate. Now you're lucky if you can find them at the door. You know, some things have to be sacrificed, unfortunately. And this is, you know, there's people out there that you can't take my firearms away. That's my Second Amendment right. Well, it's not somebody's Second Amendment right to go into a school and kill children. So this is a very powerful social commentary. It's very well done. It's very thought provoking. And I bet if you toss this into a cocktail party, the argument wouldn't end.
No, it wouldn't.
And
at your own peril.
What did you think, Mika?
Oh, Neutron. I don't know if you want me to comment after all those comments. I'm gonna say that I'm gonna disagree with everyone who comments on this piece. I'm sorry. I would also say that I think this poem is confused. One of the first things that struck me is, of the four horsemen, only war do we wage on ourselves. I don't think that's true. I think the four horsemen are all things that we perpetrate against ourselves. You know, obviously war is one of them, but famine is absolutely perpetrated from country on another country. You know, pestilence could, you know, I think in one of the more modern iterations of the apocalypse in novel, it was pestilence was also conflated with pollution, which is something that we perpetrate on ourselves. And death, of course, is similar to war. Death itself is something that we absolutely cause on our fellow man. But I would say to say that the people who manufacture guns are complicit in murder, I think, is a slippery slope. And I also would say that to give up freedom for the sake of security, I understand the merits of that argument, but I also think that's a slippery slope, a very slippery slope. And
oh,
that
is.
My comment.
It's interesting. Yeah.
Thank you, Mika.
I always love your
take on don't ever be afraid to throw some punches. Robbie, would you like to read the next poem by Eurowitz?
Oh, okay. Let me just get to my other tab here. Okay. Okay. Empty Promise, that one?
That's the one.
Okay. Nice and short. Don't make an empty promise. You made a promise unless it's a health reason, unless it's a safety reason. You cannot back out. It's in the Bible. You must not lie.
Thank you, Robbie. And just for everyone to know, this was written for the prompt. Commitment is an act, not a word. And with that, I'll get Captain to comment first.
This is brief even for a brevity. But you made a promise, unless it's a health reason or a safety reason, you cannot back out. I think there is a lot of meat in that statement. If you think that is just fluff or air, or just a bluster, try making a promise to a child and then trying to back out of it. That will definitely backfire on you every time. And I think we can all remember in our childhood someone making a promise to us about something and then reneging on it. I think you carry that, the memory of that disappointment and the betrayal with you the rest of your life. And I think when you don't keep a promise to someone, there is a sense of betrayal, because in a promise, you're asking for someone's trust. And this is a really, this is a very weighty brevity, very, very, very succinct, very to the point, but a lot of gravitas.
Thank you, Bobby. And
Mika, what did you think?
Well, I agree with you, Bobby. And I like that in such a short piece, even though, you know, it is a reminder of the importance of a promise and the importance of commitment, there's still these outs that are given. Like unless it's a health reason or unless it's a safety reason, you cannot back out. I like that there's still these little outs because it's so hard. There really is no absolutes. But some of my favorite mythologies and I think even maybe some of Sartre's plays deal with the theme of backing out from an oath for reasons that seem understandable, but the punishments do not are not alleviated by that. So I don't know. I thought that was interesting.
Good point.
Thanks, Megan. And Robbie, what did you think?
It was short but punchy, and it just made me think of when you're in those situations, when you're kind of evaluating for yourself, you know, how far do you take a promise that you made? It's like one in particular that like you would have made before that when it was easier to keep that promise, as opposed to later on down the line when it's harder because circumstances have changed. That's kind of where my focus got to. Is kind of that conflict that you get within yourself when you've made a promise to somebody or to yourself, and all of a sudden you're thinking to yourself, well, I want to keep this promise, but where's the line where I say that I can't, you know, keep this promise and do what I said that I was going to do.
Right, Robbie. And finally, Mark, would you like to round out the comments for the poem?
Yeah, I thought it was very strong, at least stated in a short number of lines. It's interesting he picked out making a promise. If you think about the Ten Commandments, a lot of the commandments are about violating various forms of promise, like bearing false witness, adultery, honoring your parents, to two or three others. There are various forms of promise. And it's interesting that the poet focused on that and says it's in the Bible because it underlies much of the Ten Commandments and much of what Jesus says in the New Commandment, New Testament. Keep your commitments above all. Don't commit adultery. Don't bear false witness. Don't violate your promises to your family. And that he focuses so strongly on it, I thought was a good choice made by the poet. Nice poem.
Thanks, Mark. And Mika, would you be able to read Peter Solway's poem next?
Yes, it's always an honor to read Peter Solway's work. Let me get there. Okay, Life, the Great Letdown by Peter Solway. Old after young, skipping pavements, dance floors, slip discs down the wheelchair ramp, Schopenhauer in Disappointment's nursing home, two-step out of the question, joy and insoluble biscuit, break all your teeth. Sartre the boaster on his stainless steel roller coaster, being and doorstopper. Once the champion existentialist of Paris Press, lover of Simone's brighter pupils, cognac and lit cigarettes. Pre-war hipster, uglier than Ginsburg or Larkin, trying lesbians, mescaline, pink Nazi lobsters all around. Chased by action, kind of unfree fun, deciding which alley, daughter of Athena? But hell, other forgetful souls in this prison, mouthing head nurse looming, all presence, Olympian heights, topping the guillotine list, time for jeans, evening injection. Dormitories of snoring thought, Nietzsche mocking, mustache choking, Schopenhauer along with the rest,
Hegel the worst, drowning in nothingness. And old fart Socrates buckling at the knees, refusing to go to bed. And
great read.
It was a great read. You know what? I'm going to take the first comment on this one because it's always a hard comment, the first comment on a Peter Sorway poem. So I just thought it was
please.
A really intelligent write. I don't often say that. I just wish my knowledge of philosophy could stand up to the content of this poem. Peter has not just sprouted the philosophy, but rather provided a sardonic commentary of the life and musings of not one but many famous philosophers. My favourite part was the end of the poem, dormitories of snoring thought, Nietzsche mocking, moustache choking, Schopenhauer, along with the rest, Hegel the worst, drowning in nothingness, and old fart Socrates buckling at the knees, refusing to go to bed. I feel inadequate reading Peter's poems, and he actually commented back and said, just making up stuff with a relevant neutron, and I just thought that was mint. And Mark, would you like to go next?
I thought this was a lovely satire on the philosophers. You know, where did they, you know, that's the question, where did they end up? And it envisions this nursing home where they're kind of all in wheelchairs and extreme old age at the end of all their thinking and kind of dealing with the results of their thoughts, broken home and broken down philosophers. I thought it was hysterical. I mean, Schopenhauer was the one who said, you know, there's no, kind of said there's no, you know, life is pretty grim. He was, and so he's breaking his teeth on that now. And Sartre, with all his talk about freedom and his things he did in his life, is a broken down presence getting injections now. I just thought it was funny. It's very thoughtful too. I mean, where did all their thinking lead them? This kind of end state. And Nietzsche, you know, he was the mocker, and then Hegel, who built these huge systems, and then Socrates, who took that hemlock, you know, it just looks at what they were, what they thought, and where their thinking ends up in a way. It's a meditation on that. It's a metaphor. All these old guys in a nursing home. I thought it was hysterically funny and beautifully written poem, very strong poem.
Thanks, Mark. That was a great comment. And Mika, what did you think?
Oh, God, I don't know how to comment on. I feel like I'm missing so much context. Whenever I read one of Peter Solway's poems, I think I need to, like, go and read 10 more books just to even, like, assimilate a comment. I don't know. I love it, and I love the way he words things. Like, when he's talking about old after young, and then immediately goes from the skipping pavements, dance floors, to slip discs down the wheelchair ramp. He's always very, like, it's almost bitter to read him because he just doesn't, he's a relentless kind of writer. The way that he writes is very, it's just bitter, but not in a way that's necessarily hopeless, just in the way that it's hard-hitting. And not hard-hitting in a, oh, that really touched my soul way, but in a, oh, God, why did you have to put it like that way?
Awesome. And what do you think, Robbie?
I think that's perfect, the way she just said it. Why did you have to put it that way, sort of a way? Because it actually reminded me of what I was talking about with someone today. Because in the poem, he's going after the less I, you know, you think of Socrates and you think of all these great quotes and everything and all those great, like, historical figures in that. But here, he's just talking about them in everyday parlance, everyday language. And you know, just could you just imagine Socrates in a nursing home, you know, and like what that would be like, and you know, telling you why your life is existential and why it's this or that, and but then just being a regular old guy at the same time. And again, it reminded me of what I was talking about today with somebody about the idealization of not people in this case, but I was talking about different eras. People will say, "Oh yeah, I remember that era. I remember the '60s, or I remember the '80s, and this and that was so great." But they go over all the great stuff. They gloss over all the bad stuff, and the very down to earth portrayals of the a lot of the great figures in this poem had reminded me of that.
Great comment, Robbie. And finally, Captain, would you like to round out the comment?
Peter Solway, I agree with Mika. There is a cynicism underlying most of Peter's work, but that's okay because it's familiar to me. I had an uncle that was the same way. That barbed cynicism, it almost feels like I've come home. He really trots out all the biggies. I mean, I'm assuming Ginsberg is Allen Ginsberg because he's a pre-war hipster. Ginsberg and Larkin, I think, is Philip Larkin, the poet. I don't know if he meant to misspell Schopenhauer's name or whether that was a slip of the H. But he's got Schopenhauer in there, Nietzsche, Hegel. It's like a roll call in here. But I find it interesting that as is typical of science and this particular discipline, he only talks about male philosophers, which I think is interesting. But the old fart Socrates, that made me laugh because my uncle, the cynic, used to love using that phrase, old fart. So this poem felt like I had gone home and was talking to my uncle. But there's some great pieces in here. I was just trying lesbians, meth, going pink Nazi lobsters all around, chased by action, kind of an unfree fun, deciding which alley, daughter of Athena. I mean, pink Nazi lobsters, the imagery that conjures, I don't think I can unsee that. But he's got some great stuff in here. Being a doorstopper, once the champion, existential of Paris Press, lover of Simone's brighter pupils, cognac and lit cigarettes. Actually, I find this piece of all of the pieces of Peter I've read actually more understandable to me, which frightens me. Where am I going with my thought process? So I actually really did enjoy. Yeah, I'm frightened now. if I'm taking drugs, I better up the dosage. But it actually is. I find this quite. This is more humorous to me than some of the other stuff he does. But it's a very wry, almost a black humor.
Thanks, Captain. That was a great comment. And Mark, would you be able to read our next poem, Rock the Boat by Damn It Dave?
Sure. Rock the boat.
You might be a little bit further away from the microphone.
Oh, sorry about that. He climbed aboard the dinghy, but he didn't grab an oar. His friends asked him to help. He said, "That's what you guys are for." He sat in front and watched them row, complaining all the while. "You guys will take forever just to row a half a mile." He taunted and he ribbed his friends for going much too slow. Then up beside his haughty head, there came a mighty blow. For one of them had had enough and whacked him with an oar.
that mouthy, pompous ass was not a problem anymore. He lay unconscious on the deck, and that was all she wrote for one conceited, mouthy fool who dared to rock the boat. End of poem.
Great. That was great. Fantastic read. And thank you, damn it, Dave. And just so you're aware, the prompt that Dave wrote to was the guy who isn't rowing has time to rock the boat. And Captain, would you like to make the first comment this time?
Sure. Now, I think that that quote is quite apropos, and that the damn it, Dave's poem really captures it in a very wry, humorous, tongue-in-cheek sort of way. People who rock the boat sometimes get dealt with in a very unpleasant manner. But we used to say that if your troops are complaining, that's good. That means they're happy. If they stop complaining is when you have to worry. But I don't think that has anything, because none of them are rowing a boat. So I think in this case, that's absolutely true. It actually reminded me of something that happened one time to me. We had our commanding officer got promoted, and so did our commanding general, and they were all going to have a party to celebrate their promotion. So my commanding officer loaned the general all of his lieutenants, and I was the only woman, but it didn't matter. So we're moving, all of us are moving, we got a working party of lieutenants moving tables and chairs, and we got one lieutenant standing there directing traffic, and we kept telling him, Steph, pick up a goddamn chair and move something. And he wouldn't. All he was doing was directing traffic, being imperious. So when we got back, we're all pissed at him, but I was the only one that fixed him. I stapled his hat to his desk. He had 200 staples in his hat that he had to pull out because I stapled his hat to his desk. But I did the same thing. I'd had an oar, I'd have hit him in the head with it.
And Mika, what did you think?
I liked it. I like damn it, Dave's writing. He always kind of cracks me up. I like, too, that this is the response to the prompt. I think the prompt has a lot to say about human nature. And, it reminds me of the apathy of the masses. You know, when it's not really something you can judge them for when everyone's just trying to, like, survive. No one has time to have lofty ideals when they're trying to feed themselves and their family. But in this one, it's more about those who take advantage of others' labor. I'm still getting something political out of it, but it's just, it works on such a down-to-earth level as well that it was very humorous. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, Mika. And Mark, what did you think?
I thought it was a great... I cracked up reading it. I thought it was a great comic poem, really well done. I just started. His friends asked him to help. He said, "That's what you guys are for." I just thought it was just very direct and very lovely humor that made the point, and just a very vivid and funny way. The technique was great. It just it's so unobtrusive. You know, the iambic tetrameter and lines 1 and 3 of each stanza, and the trimeter and 2 and 4. It was just very unobtrusive and very natural with the rhyme. It was great technique and beautiful description. Just a very great comic poem. Really loved it.
Thanks, Mark. I think you touched on a lot of my points. The only thing I was going to say in addition to that is it rings true metaphorically and in reality, as Captain mentioned, and just the saying about idle hands being the devil's work. So a very well done poem.
Yes, I have to add that he never did find out who did it.
Well, he might now.
Said you're talking about Seth, right? Seth never found out who did it, right?
He never found out who did it, and I enjoyed it all the more because he didn't know who did it.
Oh, gosh. And next we've got a poem by, bear with me for a moment, Shannon Norman, and it's called Philosophy is a Smile on a Dog. And it goes, the casual of war are neither rich or poor, my wise philosopher friend. The casualties of war are like the casualties of any win-lose situation. They tried to think out of the box. They tried win-win. And we all chanted, you can't please everyone all the time. Should the rich wage a war where or when the poor would suffer or die, the rich would cease to be rich. Therefore, they would have committed suicide. Rich cannot be rich without the poor to define them. But the poor remain blessed, as another wise philosopher stated, because they retain riches that the rich simply don't understand. End poem. And I will get Mika to make the first comment.
Oh, my God, bad timing. I'm sorry. Can you give me a couple comments?
No worries. Look, I'll go first on this one. I thought it was a wise piece of poetry, albeit a bit black and white in part, but it is true that some of the poorest nations rate higher on the UN Happiness Index of rated countries. And they have, in my humble opinion, experienced hardships and can appreciate the wins, the small and big successes. You cannot please everyone all the time, this is true, but there is compromise. And I think the intent of the prompt was to show that the poor die at the hands of decisions made by those who are rich or have greater power. And I think you have captured that. Mark, what did you think?
Yeah, I agree with that comment. You know, it's a wise poem. It's thoughtful. I love the third stanza where they try to rationalize it. You know, the casualties of war when conflict occurs of any type, you know, they're going to be casualties, and then. People try to jump in and rationalize it. You can't please everybody all the time, win-win, all those kinds of cliches to kind of deal with, the casualties that occur in any type of conflict, because I thought it was more general than just physical war, the point being made here. And then segueing into, you know, kind of a bottom line thing that it's the system that's enforcing all this. The rich cannot be rich without the poor to define it, and the kind of machinery of society generating this conflict. You know, the situation, and just in the end, you have to stay yourself. You have to stay connected to basic values, because they're what matters. It's just a very moral and a thoughtful poem about the conflict in life. Very strongly written.
Thank you, Mark. That was a great comment. And Captain, what's your take on it?
I enjoyed it thoroughly. I loved the title. It gives, it's almost like something, this is philosophy by Dr. Seuss, but it does touch on some very salient points. Should the rich rage a war where or when the poor would suffer or die, the rich would cease to be rich, and therefore would have committed suicide. Rich cannot be rich without the poor. That is the yin and yang of life. You cannot have darkness without light. You cannot have good without evil. Because if there's no balance, there's no contrast. It's like saying if everyone's beautiful, then no one's beautiful. If everyone's smart, then no one's smart. But it reminds me of a quote by Robert Ingersoll, who said that I think he wrote The Liberty of Man, Woman, and Child, and he said something about he'd rather be a French peasant live in a hut with a vine growing over the door and standing next to his wife with his children around him. He'd rather have been that man and gone down into the tongueless silence of dreamless death than to have been Napoleon the Great. So he would have been, he would have rather been happy in a simple life than have led a complex, wealthy and highly famous life. And there's something to be said for that, because there are people, if you look at celebrities, they're rich, they're popular. What are they sacrificing? You know, you get chased around by people with cameras. Your life isn't your own. You have no privacy. But the poor remain blessed, as another wise philosopher stated, because they retain riches that the rich simply don't understand. And that last stanza is so profound in its simplicity. I mean, that in itself is a poem that could stand by itself. And it mirrors what Robert Ingersoll said. So I think that there's a lot to this.
Thank you, Captain. That was a great comment, as always. And Mika, are you ready to comment, or did you want me to jump onto the next poem?
I'll comment real quickly. I was just going to say I like the title as well. It's a line from the song by Edie Brickell and the New Bohemians.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'll have to look that up.
Yeah, it's a really good song. You guys should definitely look it up if you haven't heard it. It's she has a couple lines that are similar to that. Philosophy is a smile on a dog. Religion, I think she says religion is a walk on slippery rocks or a joke on a cereal box, one of the two. But it's a pretty cool song. You guys would like it.
You post that information on the board. I think we'd all like to share that because it sounds like that's a wonderful trick.
Yeah,
it's a good song. I'll post it on there. But yeah, it was a good write. I'll contribute to other people's comments on this piece otherwise.
And Mika, would you be able to cue Babbler's SoundCloud?
Yes, absolutely. Let me go ahead and play that. And I'll press play now. The volume was all the way down. I'm sorry. I'm starting over.
This is why we send the poor. War is wet socks in a steel toe boot, rotting the foot and chewing the leather, wearing thin at heel and toe, limp and toes aside, smelling foul, leaving the wearer raw but blistered, scarred yet functional. It is no Sunday golf in crisp whites. And this is why we send the poor. Victuals of war are dry and off-tasting, palatable to a thunderous belly. Percolated coffee littered with grounds, off-puttingly reminiscent of the color of old blood, regurgitated or defecated, yet it is gulped down by aching throats, grateful for bitter drugs. It is no filet mignon seared to perfection, and this is why we send the poor. The uniforms of war are utilitarian, stitched thick canvas material and sturdy pockets that haul instruments of death. Sweat rolls down in rivers under hot foreign suns. As the marching plods on, camouflage drinks from the pruned bodies beneath. It is no haute couture from the spring collection, and this is why we send the poor. War presses sockets against iron crosses to blow holes through fellow man, sending entrails into the eyes of their kin, blue fingers flexed against the triggers, praying to the multitude of gods, this is not murder, confident that some distant tomorrow will be different and pull. It is not halo on your Italian leather sofa. And this is why we send the poor. War scrapes against the bottom of wills, collecting the last bit of purpose. ekes out that last pulsing coal, next heavy footfall, next pulse, next breath, searing it against the cheek of death, stretching out the heat on blind faith that victory is just ahead while a fallen sky crushes the spine. It is no cushy position given by Daddy. And this is why we send the poor. The rich do not have what it takes to answer the roar of hell, to scream profanity at the monsters of a broken mind. Buttersoft palms bleed at the thought, trigger untouched. Shallow vats of fortitude scrape away easily, like congealed fat, to clog the arterioles of victory. Their blubbery bodies drown in simpering salt water because money didn't solve the problem. And this is why we should send the rich. End poem.
Wow.
That was fantastic.
Wow.
And Mark, I'll get you to make the first comment if you'd like.
Well, this was so powerful, this poem. I've never read anything quite like this about warfare, because it gets into the, and exploitation, it gets into the total physicality, and the whole poem is kind of this relentlessness, a relentless focus on it, all aspects of it, and yet it doesn't, the relentlessness doesn't pal. It just gets, it's very deeply poetic. It makes the physical experience, all dimensions of the physical experience. But the poem doesn't overdo it either. It's a beautiful poem in that way. All the aspects of physical experience. It communicates so well the oppression that's occurring, the dismemberment, the pruned bodies beneath the camouflage. The rich are exploiting the poor. That's a lovely refrain, and this is why we send the poor, because we can treat them like units. We can tear them apart and reassemble them into kind of units that are there to kill. Because we're able to, from the rich point of view, we can do this to the poor, so we're going to do it, and we're going to turn them into killing instruments, and this is the physicality of how it occurs, and it's so true. If you think of World War One, this reminds me of that, the war in the trenches. In some ways, the worst war was all the rich generals sending the people into the machine guns and barbed wire, and this expresses it so well, so very well. It's a great poem.
That was a great comment, Mark. And I'll get Mika to go next if you're available.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. First of all, great comment, Mark, and I'm so glad we had a SoundCloud from Babbler. I love to hear her read her own poetry. I don't know. I think I would just comment on how intense the way that she evoked. Mark was saying the same thing, but I was struck by it as well. How intense she evokes the realities of war, especially this percolated coffee littered with grounds, off-puttingly reminiscent of the color of old blood, regurgitated or desiccated. That one is one of my favorite parts. I think just her gift with language. She's one of those writers who puts things in a way that is refreshing and just completely different from anything you've read. But it's not trying to be original. It's not trying to be so different that it loses its connection with what it's trying to say. It's very like every word is very well used.
I agree with you wholeheartedly there. I'll get actually Captain to comment next on this poem, and then I'll follow through and we'll jump on to the next one.
This is a fascinating piece. I don't know if you noticed that there's a lot in here that's familiar to me, very, very familiar. When my father was in World War II, he complained about the fact that when he was in the Pacific, sometimes there would be days before they would take off their boots and their socks had rotted on their feet. and that's where you get the term jungle rot. I'm sure none of you have ever heard that term before. But the way she starts her piece and then crescendos, she starts very simple. War is wet socks and a steel-toed boot. And she's starting very simple with the discomfort of having to wear, and I've never been to war. I've been out in the field where it's been days where I haven't taken off my clothing, haven't had a shower, haven't had a warm meal, slept on the ground. It's not fun. And she says, and this is why we send the poor. It's no Sunday golf. I love the last line in each stanza is a striking contrast to everything that she has described before. Limp and toes aside, smelling foul. And then she goes into the rations, the food, victuals of war, great word, dry and off-tasting, palatable to a thunderous belly, percolated coffee. Yeah, you will eat and drink things out in the field that if you were home, you would go, you're out of your mind, I'm not going to eat that. But you, and I'm not from the MRE generation, I'm from the C-Rat generation, where everything came in green cans, and you had to stuff them in your pockets. And if you didn't have any kind of sterno, you ate it cold. It's gulped down by aching throats, grateful for bitter drugs. Yeah, sometimes you're glad to stop and just eat whatever you've got in your pockets. It doesn't matter, especially if you've been on watch and you missed the hot chow. This is why we send the poor. Then she goes into the uniforms. So she started very simple with the socks, talks about them, then she goes to the uniforms. And they're utilitarian, they're thick. And believe I was stationed in the desert for 6 years. Sweat rolls down in rivers under hot foreign suns. Yes, as marching clods on camouflage drinks from pruned bodies beneath, that really hit home with me because we're wearing camouflage utilities in the desert. We didn't have desert cami at the time. So you want to see, vision something ridiculous, green camouflage out in the desert. That's what we were wearing. And just as hot as it could be, why we send the poor. And then she goes into some really gut-wrenching stuff, the real guts of war. This is multitude, praying to multitudes of God that this is not murder. And this is, she talks about the visceral bloodletting of war. And I love the subtlety. This is not Halo. For the uninitiated, Halo is a gourmet ice cream. This is not Halo on your Italian leather sofa. And it just, war scrapes against the bottom of wills, collected last bit. She goes into the psychology. She goes from socks to food, to uniforms, to the actual battle. And then she goes into the psychology of it. How it just drains the psyche and stretches out the heat on blind faith that victory is just ahead, while a fallen sky crushes the spine. And this is just, and then in the contrast, the last one where she says, and this is why we should send the rich, because how many battles, how many wars are started by men who, and forgive me guys, but it's testosterone that drives the bus most times, that is started by someone who's never been in battle, who doesn't know what it's like. You want to see a really, really accurate sampling of battle, watch the beginning scenes on Saving Private Ryan. It will chill you to the bone. It will just curdle you. It's real as you can get on a Hollywood set as far as war, and shows the utter waste of it. And she has, this has got to be the best thing that Babbler has ever written. I mean, this is superb. I am definitely saving this in my personal stash. And if she weren't a picker on HP or on the FPP, I'd put this forward. I'm going to have to wait until she gets off of duty so I can put it forward for an FPP. But I'm sorry, I'm a bit verbose, but this one really hit home with me.
Yeah, I just think the formatting of thought was remarkable. And the ending line, and this is why we should send the rich, expressed the idea that those that are effectively warmongering lack the inner fortitude to put their money where their mouth is. And if they had to personally fight the wars they waged, there would be less war. And if they were the ones physically pulling the trigger, would diplomatic dialogue be the preferred option of choice? I just, I thought it was brilliant. I do agree with you. This is one of the best pieces I've read of Babbler's.
Absolutely. There used to be, there's custom in certain societies, and I can't think of them at the time, right now, I think, tribal, where if two tribes or two clans or two bodies go to war, rather than having everyone fight, they either send out their leaders or they send out the two best warriors they have. And that's how the victory or the defeat is determined, by the two warriors in the middle of the battlefield. And that solves the problem. If you see the beginning of the movie Troy, that's what they said. They sent this behemoth out to fight Achilles, and Achilles just takes him out in one or two strokes, and that's the end of it. And then the battle's over, and they win.
There'd be a lot less cannon fodder that way, that's for sure.
Amen.
And I think it answers the prompt very
beautifully,
very well.
Oh my!
Yeah,
magnificent.
And Mika, would you like to add anything?
Are you on mute by any chance?
I'm not on mute, but I think I commented on this poem. Is this Babbler's piece still?
Sorry.
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. I just wanted to make sure I didn't miss the next poem. I got a little distracted, but I think I did comment on Babbler's piece.
Sorry about that. For some reason, I'm doing the reverse of when I missed a Faziana. Now I'm picking up twice on it.
That's okay.
Drop the next poem. And Mika, if you are able to, would you be able to read this next poem? I'll just put it in the forum. Okay. All right, so it's by Lady Braveheart.
Okay, Discreetly Disenchanted by Lady Braveheart. Layered within the psyche, sandwiched between the words, tossing forth in the memory. Look at those smitten words. Truth thus was discreetly disdained. Lame statements and the roaring response. What a hypocrisy. Flawed thoughts in inferno. Audacious heart still dreams of the heaven, and it does. After all, it shrinks to what we perceive. Ah, the stories, the faith and the fate, sheer bait. The collective conscience has no other escape. End poem.
Should read the author's note.
Captain, if you want to read it.
Ask Mika to read the author's note.
It is so bizarre and difficult to accept the fact that the outwardly many perfect beings are so hollow, heartbroken, and at chaos. Their lies always are run from the conscience. People try their best to hide and invest their enormous strength in projecting something new, which has no correlation to the gory reality. This, however, reflects us in the present world. End quote.
Wow.
Thank you, Mika. And Captain, would you like to go first with the comment this time?
Sure. I wish I knew which prompt she had selected. It makes it kind of easier to weigh it against what it inspired her. But as a standalone, this is a very, very good brevity. It's a very good piece. There's some great language in here, great use of vocabulary. Lame statements and the roaring response. What a hypocrisy. Clawed thoughts in inferno. Audacious heart still dreams of heaven, and it does. That stanza really, but the whole thing from start to finish is very, it's very articulate. It's very well written, and it's just a very good piece for brevity. It's very concise. The collective conscience has no other escape. The ending is dynamite.
Thank you, Bobby. And Mark, what did you think? Did Mark drop Mika?
No, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, cool. Yeah, I can hear you now.
You are.
All righty. Okay. Yeah, and that's a poem that makes you think. I've read it two or three times through, plus the AN. It's just all the people out there trying to project themselves to each other. Is what I got out of it. Using their looking at the AN, they invest their enormous strength in projecting something new, which is no correlation to the gore reality of what's in themselves and around them. And that's what the poem captures. We'll look at those smitten words that people are saying about themselves and what's around them, which don't reflect the truth. Is what the claim being made by the poem. There's a lot of self-delusion out there. There's a lot of attempts to create a story for about yourself and sell it to other people. All the stories, which are sheer bait for each other. We're all trying to impress, the poem's saying, and that's the kind of situation we're in this kind of disconnected society. We're just all out there trying to make connection. It's very thoughtful and kind of sad, but in a lot of ways accurate. It's a great poem.
Great comment.
Thanks, Mark. I just have to say, going off of the author note, it was a very apt take on the present world, and it reminds me of this very prevalent thing, just, I suppose, in modern day, and it's the highlight showreel that is social media, for example, and the tide of social influences. The opening stanza was my favourite, laid within the psyche, sandwiched between the words, tossing forth in the memory, look at those smitten words, truth thus was discreetly disdained. And it reminded me of the saying, never let the truth get in the way of a good story. Very well done.
Yeah.
And Mika, you read the poem. What did you think?
Sorry. I liked it a lot. The lame statements and the roaring response, what a hypocrisy, Claude Thoughts and Inferno. I really liked that section. I was taken aback by the author's notes, because whatever interpretation I had of the poem beforehand was changed by the author's notes, and I'm glad you had me read that, Bobby. But I thought she spoke to that message in our author's notes very well.
Thank you, Mika. I will grab the next poem. I believe there is a SoundCloud for Gerald E. Green, and I'm just bringing up the poem now. Mika, it won't be a moment.
Yes, I see
okay.
It. I'll press play in a moment.
Okay, it won't be a sec. Copy. All right, it's in the board.
Bad Company, written and read by Gerald Green. Am I the only person lonely when alone? Or are there others with this emptiness, where hungry souls strain with uneasiness? I look for purpose here among the thorns, where fate has placed its burdens without cause, and here I suffer under nature's laws, as days stretch long and mirrors aggravate. This providence brings out the worst in me, while nights exacerbate my malady. It must be fear that hammers this bent nail, persistent pounding, pointless suffering that mars and damages with every swing. Seclusion suffocates the heart because it takes two notes to render harmony. When I'm alone, I'm in bad company. End poem.
Wow.
Thank you for the SoundCloud, Gerald. I think up until COVID hit, loneliness was a bad word or an undesirable admission. A lot of people did not have the opportunity to sit with oneself. Rather, they were able to surround themselves with noise, people, hobbies, crowds, in order to avoid their own company. I think I was guilty of that to a certain degree, as I think most people are. And because my mind was unable to sit still, I had ants in my pants, so to speak, and a great sense of restlessness. But in that quietude of COVID, I learned to express myself through writing, and I was able to connect to a collaborative consciousness through late night poets. And I think your poem touches on the prompt really well. You may be in bad company, but we're not alone. And I think that is why mental health issues have been exacerbated during the pandemic. My favorite part was, it must be fear that hammers this bent nail, persistent pounding, pointless suffering that mars and damages with every swing. This rings so very true. And what did you think, Captain?
Well, I'm going to take one of Mika's stands. I'm going to disagree with it. I am content. As a matter of fact, I wrote a poem called Fearlessly Alone. And I enjoy solitude. It's a seclusion suffocates the heart because it takes two notes to render harmony. When I'm alone, I'm in bad company. I disagree. I like being in my own company. I find that there's a difference between being lonely and being alone. And when you're in your own company, you have a chance to reflect on who you are. You're not distracted by other voices, the cacophony of daily life. You get to sit and reflect on where you are, who you are, if you are who you want to be, what you want to change. There's no one else's agenda driving you. And so but I understand, because I know people who cannot be alone. My ex-husband was like that. He couldn't be alone. The solitude would close in on him. And it says, I'm the only person lonely when alone, or are there others in this emptiness where a hungry soul strained with uneasiness? I personally, I've listened to all the talk about the lockdown and the seclusion and the sequestering. And it has rolled off of me like water off a duck's back. It's like there's been absolutely no material change in my life. But I listen to other people, and I can sympathize, because some people they thrive in the company of others, and I don't. And it's days stretch long and mirrors aggravate. This providence brings out the worst in me while nights exacerbate my malady. Again, it's like last night we had a poem about some people were writing about Mother's Day, and they were extolling their mothers. And when it came to me to comment, I said, I cannot relate to this, because my mother was a whack job. So there's just something. She was. I honestly, I envy people who have those kind of rapport with their mom. I just it just wasn't me. And here's, it's the same thing here. To me, solitude is home. I'm fine. I spend days. It'll be 2 weeks before I go out of the house, and I'm fine.
Yeah.
So, but it's well written, and I can feel the anxiety in it, but it's not relatable to me.
Great comment, Captain. It's always refreshing to hear a different take on the poem. and from your own life experience as well. And Mark, what did you think?
Well, I'm going to reply to Bobby's comment a little bit in the and the poem both. The I thought it was a great comment and kind of offered a different perspective. But I would suggest, you know, the poem's asking the question, well, I happen to feel this way, this kind of disconnect. Am I alone? Are there others out there? And we're all different and all in different balances, and which yes. What Captain said reflects, you know, the strongly connected feeling in her life. And I thought it was really interesting to hear in the context of reading this poem. It's just all the different people out there connected and with each other in different ways, you know, with their own kind of personalities and positions. But this is what the poem's showing. It's pretty common. I mean, you just have to look around at all the kind of poverty and disconnect and the people displaced. They're many of them are alone. They're on the fringe. They're coming from fragmented backgrounds, and you know they're living in fear. This poem captures that part of the what's occurring, just as Bobby's comments captured, you know, that there it is still possible to achieve a strong sense of balance. It was really interesting to listen to her comment in the context of what we're really reading here. What's occurring now in society, and but it doesn't have to kind of lead a person to despair either. Just a nice experience reading and listening to the comment.
Thank you, Mark. That was a great comment. And Mika, would you like to round out the comments for the poem?
Yes. I was really taken by the second stanza. I look for purpose here among the thorns, where fate has placed its burdens without cause. And here I suffer under nature's laws. I really, really like that, because looking for purpose and reason, reason behind the things that you go through in life can be such a frustrating and fruitless pursuit. Because as they say, where fate has placed its burdens without cause, fate doesn't have rhyme or reason, and there is no justice. And nature's law is the law of chaos. So I think, you know, that just that frustration with the injustice and the, lack of order in the world, I relate to.
Thanks, Mika. And next we've got a poem, which I might actually get Mika to read, because I think your voice would suit this really well. It was a great comment, by the way, by Colap, if you're available.
Oh, absolutely. It would be an honor.
Oh.
Stranger, take heed of the following, by Colap. We did not ask to be born. We are a product of an act between two people, whether cognizant or not. Here we are, naked to the world, slapped on our backside is how we are welcomed to it. And from there on, we are alone with the help or not of a mother's swollen breast feeding us her milk, or a surrogate mother with hers, or from a bottle of Nestle powdered milk held with love or not. We are then gifted with vitamins and antibodies to last us a lifetime, its length unbeknownst to us in the chess game of life. We are dependent on a benevolent soul until we are healthy, sturdy enough to start walking, running, and cycling on our own, to spread our wings and take off. Once of legal age, our genitors can set us free into the wide expanse of liberty, pregnant with dangers and possibilities. Inhaling and exhaling, we are provided with this existence. Take it or leave it, but life is for the living. So living we must. Living in itself is a commitment. What we do with it, every single choice is political, even though we might not be aware of this. Every choice is related to the next one, like the links of a chain that we wear around our neck. Words fill empty space where people pretend to render less vacuous their futile conversations. Put your money where your mouth is, a cruder way to say action speaks louder than words. Thus, before taking any action, information and thought are required to make the right decision that can lead to the right act. For once undertaken, a passive act such as that of learning, one is digging neural paths in the brain, irrigating hormones that spray positive thoughts or negative ones. Once the learning is done, it would take a series of unlearning in order to erase the first mistake. Take the example of learning how to get from one place to the next for the first time. If we take the wrong route, the next time we'll repeat the same error again and again. Even when we realize the mistake and try to correct it, we'll begin with the mistaken one in a subconscious manner. Then once realization takes over, we veer to the corrected itinerary until one day we finally deleted the first mistaken step from our mind. Think about it. How much time does it take to get to that corrected version? Then we finally learn the right route. Imagine this pattern in the so many thousands of times we undertake tasks in the myriads of micro-events of our days. For each act, no matter how minor it may be, is still an act that requires serious reflection before acting on it in order to live a moral life, following yin or yang roads, bifurcating in loops and re-loops before we return towards the main Tao of existence, leaving very little room for spontaneity if we want to do it right. These are just rambling thoughts after a long life of spontaneous decisions that have resulted in a life chosen with a person somehow wired with a proclivity towards dark forces, inclined to criticize, denigrate, and destroy when the vital force is to lean towards the light as a sunflower would. So, fellow strangers, if you happen to stumble upon this counsel, take it to heart, all that was said above, for it comes from an old rock whose edges have been polished over the bumpy road of life. And pump.
Superb read.
Great. Yeah. Captain, would you like to go first this time?
I really enjoy Co-op's work. This is a different format for her, but it's so philosophical in her approach and so in depth, the attention to detail here. Living in itself is a commitment. As you read, you've got preamble in several paragraphs in front. She's got us born and living or leaving home. And life in itself is a commitment. What we do with it, every single choice is political, even though we may not be aware of this. Every choice is related to the next one, like the links of a chain that we wear around our neck. That paragraph right there, that segment is just, I think, that's the apex of this whole piece. She's got us going through learning and rambling thoughts and what have you, but that in itself is the just the core of and it the take on the prompt, it's spot on. Commitment is an act, not a word. And she's got living is a commitment. And this is just an absolutely stellar piece of prose.
Thank you, Captain. That was a great comment. And Mika, what did you think?
Well, it was an honor to read it. And I think it's always an honor to read anything by Colap. She has a very sharp wit in some of her writes, and in other ones, there's so much wisdom that it's almost unbearable to read because you don't even want to think about it that deeply. It's painful stuff that she approaches. And I like this piece because it does approach those painful topics, but with such a detached sense of it, almost like picking an object up and examining it from every angle. That's how I feel like she's looking at life in this poem. I thought I really liked, I guess my favorite part would be for once undertaken a passive act such as that of learning, one is digging neural paths in the brain, irrigating hormones that spray positive thoughts or negative ones. I like that, you know, intention is so important. And here she talks about the intention that comes from how,
what you learn and how you learn it, not even just the actions that you take that are, as she would say, not passive, but are passive actions are important as well. And I like her point about what it takes to unlearn once you've made a mistake once, what it takes to stop yourself from making that mistake again and again. It's a very good point.
It's excellent. I was, several years ago, I read a book. I wish I could remember what the author, the source of it was, but the author made a statement that rats are smarter than people. Because if you put a rat in a maze with the object of finding the piece of cheese, once the rat finds it, it figures out the path and it'll find it every time. But then if you move the cheese, once the rat realizes that that path doesn't work, they'll start exploring again and they'll find the new path to the cheese. Whereas people, once they find the cheese, we'll take the same path every time, and if the cheese gets moved, people will set up lawn chairs and wait for the cheese to come back. They don't go exploring.
Very well said. So true. Mika, I was actually drawn to the same part as well, and I suppose so much focus is put on spontaneity or going with the flow, at least in my or our generation. And I dare say it's a testament to you, spontaneity, that yin and yang dance. But far more focus should or could be placed on living a good life, however you choose to define that, is up to the individual. Living with purpose rather than grasping at leaves on a bubbling brook with chopsticks. So I thought it was a really good poem. And she actually wrote back and said, yes, teach your children well. A good life is not one based on the material. The Sufis got it right. Dance, move your body, be connected with the only, and in my language, the Tao, which Buddha also talked about. So I thought that was a really interesting comment from Kolap as well.
That's a great comment. I love that. Rather than grasping at least. Her last comment, I agree with you, brilliant. Yours.
Yeah. Thanks. And Mark, would you like to round out the comments for this poem?
Yeah, I'll be quick. Yeah, I like the contrarian kind of comments that have come up a couple of times in this particular group of commentators. So I'm going to be a little contrarian. I found it kind of depressing in some ways. It says you better get it right if you want to meet your objectives. You know, before taking any action, information and thought are required to make the right decision. Then later on, leaving very room for spontaneity to do it right. And this isn't the experience of my own life anyway, you know, it's not the experience of the poet's life. She made spontaneous decisions and ended up in a destructive situation. And her advocacy now is think things through and make sure you get it right and move on. And, you know, there's something, I don't know, it's just not the way it is for a lot of people. You make impulsive decisions based on affection and love and inexperience, and you rush in and you're left holding what you have and trying to move on for that. Push back on kind of the advocacy from the planned life, which is what I took back. But I also understand where she's coming from, that you do need kind of healthy thinking and healthy connection, and you do need to learn from your experience. So just a very thoughtful poem about life and how you move ahead.
Thank you, Mark. That's much appreciated. And I think it's good to have, which we've had today, a lot of different views, and not everyone just mirroring the comments of the last person. I think it makes for a very interesting discussion. So, yeah. With that, Mark, would you be able to read Banyulin's poem? I've just put it in on the board.
Let's see. Banyulin, that's After the Benjamins? Okay, yeah. What happened after the last I love you went spiraling through Wi-Fi? That's a... Since we've separated, you don't know what to be other than drunk and silent. And I want to ask you so many questions like, is your love for me still showing up every day, ready to tackle my absence? And has your need for me become a narcissist now that you insist I'm impossible? Maybe it's my addiction to writing poems about us without mentioning what we do in the bedroom. And now I've been writing about current events and what sucks outside of you and me. Is that what you wanted? For me to branch out? You say there was always something missing from making us last. Was it my ass? Because I wasn't there to slap? Are you over me? Because I'm not under you when you flick the lights? Maybe that crossed the line. But who's to say? Line is a circle, and no matter where I step, it's always a shallow reason. I'm just juggling conclusions because you leave me so many. And now you don't know what else to be other than drunk and silent. What happened after the last I love you went spiraling through Wi-Fi? Did you decide I wasn't worth the risk of writing anymore? Maybe you're into someone new and she has all her shit together. I figured that day would come. I went out and worried about it on a sidewalk curb the day after my birthday, but you forgot again. Saw trash fly down the street when the wind got upset that some trees were still standing. It's just strange looking back and seeing our roots tangle, not knowing that rot was occurring every time you wondered what comes next. I was wondering what would stay. End of poem.
Fantastic read. Now, we've got about...
What happened?
Lisa?
Can you hear me?
Now I can.
Hello. Okay, cool. Yeah, I was just saying we'll do like 1 minute per person and for sure. Benjamin, so I'll get you to start, Captain.
I really enjoyed this. This is very colloquial in its approach, but very matter-of-fact, asks some... I like the way it asks questions and doesn't provide answers. It's very provocative, and I like the ending. Every time you wondered what comes next, I was wondering what would stay. I can relate to some of this because I went through a relationship like that, and you ask yourself, why am I still here? And it does a great... interpretation of the prompt. You could always keep writing and love me from afar.
Thanks, Captain. I agree with everything you said there. I was in a codependent relationship with a narcissist, and I felt the drive to write about it also in order to process it. And eventually, as Benjamin mentioned, she's written about other things. But as with all things, occasionally you're drawn back in. Much like a relentless, thankless relationship, it's just part and parcel of it.
Yeah.
I think not seeing the roots rotting at the time is just part and parcel of not having perspective and not seeing how truly toxic those people are and they are for your psyche. And I'll leave it at that so other people can comment. And Mika, what did you think?
I thought this was absolutely beautiful. It's just strange looking back and seeing our roots tangle, not knowing that rot was occurring. I think that's so profound. I you know, a lot of Bangelin's rites leave me with kind of an ache, and I think this one is the same as well. But just that part of, in hindsight, knowing that rot was occurring as the roots began to tangle, that feeling really hit me.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, that was a great comment, and I totally agree with you there. And then finally, Mark, would you like to make the last comment for the night? Mark, you might need to move a bit closer to the microphone.
Yeah, I love this poem. It was lovely and kind of devastating poem. There's just the day after my birthday with you, forgot again, saw trash fly down the street, feeling this discarded feeling, this mistreated feeling. It was just beautifully stated, a very moving poem. And the last stanza, I was wondering what would say, mithril poetry. It's just a great poem, a great way to conclude the night. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Mark. I just want to say a big thank you to you, Mark, Robbie, Bobby, Mika, for all the wonderful comments, and of course to the poets who have contributed to the evening. We have quite a few poems left over. There will be an upcoming episode where I catch up on all the carryovers. And if you refer to Neutron Bomb or Captain B2 or Incoherent Dust or Victoria Frost, or even just late night poets and the contests that have been contributed by members, you'll find all of the details for our upcoming contests. All right. With that, I will...
Great conversation.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it? It was fantastic. Thank you, all of you.
Good night,
show, guys.
Night.
Good night,
night, Mika.
Good night. Bye.
Good night. I'll post the song again if you guys want to hear it. Have a good night.
Awesome.